All right. Well, this morning we are part three of Revelation. It's kind of odd for me to say that. I didn't expect when I came here a year ago within the next year to be saying, hey, let's continue our series on Revelation. But the way the lectionary worked out, I'm really happy that it did work out this way. I've really enjoyed this. Hopefully you're getting something out of it. And we've got I think, two more weeks in this. And then we have Ascension and then one more Revelation than Pentecost. So we're moving through. We've only got about three left. Today we're in Revelation chapter 7, and we're going to begin in verse 9. And today is another one of those shifting images that we saw last week. Remember last week we had the shifting image where he is looking to see the lion, but when he actually turns to look, remember that image morphs into a lamb that has been freshly slaughtered or slain. So today is the famous 144,000 passage. So if you've ever wondered about the 144,000, I'm not sure if it will clarify it today for you, but we'll give it a shot and see what happens. So let's just begin reading in verse 9 and see what God may be saying to us today. After this, I looked, and there was a great multitude that no one could count from every nation, from all tribes and people and languages, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, robed in white, with palm branches in their hands. They cried out in a loud voice, saying, salvation belongs to our God, who is seated on the throne, and to the Lamb. And all the angels stood around the throne, and around the elders and the four living creatures, and they fell on their faces before the throne and worshiped God, singing, amen. Blessing and glory and wisdom and thanksgiving and honor and power and might be to our God forever and ever. Amen. Then one of the elders addressed me, saying, who are these robed in white, and where have they come from? I said to him, sir, you are the one that knows. Then he said to me, these are they who have come out of the great ordeal. They have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. For this reason, they are before the throne of God and worship him day and night within his temple. And the one who is seated on the throne will shelter them. They will hunger no more and thirst no more. The sun will not strike them, nor any scorching heat. For the Lamb at the center of the throne will be their shepherd, and he will guide them to the springs of the water of life. And God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. The word of God for the people of God. This just keeps getting better and better, right? Like, I feel like, seriously, at the end of each passage that we read in Revelation, we should just, like, take an altar call and go home. Because this is really all that you need right here just to hear this. This is, in many ways, a continuation or an extension of a lot of the symbols and the passage that we read from last week. Remember, we were in chapter 5 last week, and we had this beautiful picture of worship around the throne. And many of the same people that were there in chapter 5 are here in chapter 7. Remember, we had the four living creatures, the witness of the four gospels that's surrounding the throne. And then we had the elders. How many elders were there? 24. 24, right. 12 from the 12 tribes of Israel, 12 representing the 12 apostles. So both the old and new covenant witnessing to the presence of God. And then you have the throne right in the center and everything. In case you're wondering if it changed, nothing changed. Everything still centers around the Lamb, right? The Lamb is still at the center. And so we have this beautiful image of worship around the throne. And so last week, what we saw is really the place where all of this worship is happening. Okay, it described to us the place, the setting, who all was there, what it looked like, the Lamb that was coming from beside the throne. It described the setting. Today, we move in a little bit closer and we see who is actually there. So it's not just the four living creatures. It's not just the elders. It's not just the Lamb that is there. But now we have this vision of John who hears of the 144,000, and then he turns and he sees an innumerable multitude that is there surrounding the throne. So we've moved from where this is happening into who is there, and we see this vision of the 144,000. Now, you saw in what we just read, there were two distinct hymns that were there. So I just want to reiterate again, The major theme of Revelation is worship. It's worship. So what I want you to do, I want to mess you up when you read Revelation. And here's how I want to mess you up. I want you to not be able to read Revelation without having to stop every time you come across a hymn or every time you come across a passage of worship. I want you to have to stop and notate it and be reminded, oh yeah, this is the reason. This is the point. It is a response to the unveiling of God's presence in the person of Jesus Christ. That's the book of Revelation. And worship is that response. It's the only response that is acceptable to the revealing of God's presence. So again, worship, 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 worship. That's what it's about. And we see several passages here, or several instances of worship in this particular passage. But again, we're moving from where it's happening to who is happening. Now, the passage that we started out with, it says, after this. Whenever you see that phrase, like after this, you should always ask the question, well, what is this after? Okay? They're trying to tell you it's after this. That's why they write it. Well, after this, what he's referring to is in the beginning of chapter 7, John sees the four angels standing at the four corners of the earth, holding back the four winds of the earth so that no one could blow on earth or see against any tree. He sees an angel ascending from the rising of the sun, having the seal of the living God. And he called out with the loud voice of the four angels who had been given power to damage earth and sea, saying, do not damage the earth or the sea or the trees until we have marked the servants of our God with the seal on their foreheads. And I heard the number of those who were sealed. 144,000 sealed from every tribe of the people of Israel. So he hears that there are these who are sealed, 144,000. And then it lists, it says, from the tribe of Judah, 12,000. The tribe of Reuben, 12,000. The tribe of Gad, 12,000. Asher, 12,000. Naphtali, 12,000. From the tribe of Manasseh, 12,000. Simeon, 12,000. Levi, 12,000. Issachar, 12,000. Zebulun, 12,000. Joseph, 12,000. Benjamin, 12,000 sealed. So all of that happens before. And then that takes us into the passage that we read this morning. It says, after these things. So the before is the unveiling of who these 144,000 are specifically. Now, there are people throughout history who have attempted to interpret this passage as saying that there are specifically 144,000 from the tribes of Israel who will be sealed. And it says 144,000, so it has to be 144,000. And there are some today who have taken this and put it into kind of a modern spin on it. So you've got Jehovah's Witness is one of the primary proponents of this, saying that there are 144,000 that will be sealed in order to basically to get into heaven. So Jehovah's Witness, if you are familiar with 144,000, you've probably tied that to Jehovah's Witness before because that's kind of their thing. They've staked their claim with that. There's a problem looking at this literally, though. There's several problems with looking at this literally, that there's actually 144,000 people who will be sealed. And here's why. If you actually look at the 12 tribes of Israel, which is what we just had here, right? 144,000 is a multiple of 12. So from each of the 12 tribes, there's 12,000 people sealed is what it's saying. If you look at this literally, there's a major problem because these aren't the 12 tribes of Israel. Many of them are tribes of Israel, but there are some tribes that aren't listed at all. And there are some that are listed that aren't tribes at all. We have Ephraim. Ephraim is nowhere in here. We have Levi, who is included, but isn't one of the tribes. Right? So this is problematic. This isn't the exact listing of the 12 tribes, nor are they in the order that you would expect them to see of the 12 tribes or the 12 sons of Israel. So this is not a literal understanding. What this is John connecting Revelation with a long-held belief inside of Jewish culture. There was this long-held belief inside of Jewish culture that when the Messiah comes, the Messiah would join forces with an end-time army of Jews that would then overthrow the powers that are over them, the powers of oppression, the powers and authorities that have ruled over them. So the Messiah would unite with this army, this vast army, and would come in and through military might would overthrow the kingdoms and powers of this world. And it was believed that this army would contain 144,000 people. And so this army that he hears about is the army of old. It's the belief that military might would combine with the Messiah in order to overthrow the powers of this world. And so when John turns to look and to see this mighty army, this apocalyptic army that is combining with the Messiah, when he turns to look at that army, what does he see? He sees an innumerable multitude from every tribe, every nation, every tongue. And this army does not have the tools of warfare in their hands. This army, instead of having a sword in their hand, has a palm branch. And their primary weapon isn't even the palm branch. You know what their primary weapon is? Their primary weapon is the worship, the praise that comes out of their mouth, that points back to the Lamb. You see, a lot of people look at the book of Revelation as this extremely violent book where people are preparing for war and you've got Armageddon and all of this. Revelation is not really a violent book at all. It subverts violence. Because you see, John, everyone is prepared for a military, an army to come through and to establish God's kingdom. But instead, how is God's kingdom established? Through the praise and the worship of the saints. Because you see, any battle that will be fought in Revelation has already been fought. It was fought right there on that cross. That's where the battle was fought. There are no great battles waiting to happen to where we're going to kill off hundreds and thousands. No. Jesus, he is the great battle. Every other battle is won by invoking the name of Jesus, by bowing down and declaring and proclaiming the worship of Jesus. That's how the saints win in Revelation. It's not through picking up a sword against kingdoms. It is through proclaiming the worship of the slaughtered Lamb. That's how we win in Revelation. I don't know about you guys, but I'm getting a little bit excited about that. Coming from my Pentecostal background, we used to say, "Now that'll preach," right? So, folks, that'll preach. There you go. Thank you. That'll preach. The Lamb has overcome. So the primary question that we have with 144,000 is not necessarily, is there an army strong enough to overthrow powers? The primary question we have with 144,000 is, will the Lamb or will the beast, Rome, will they have authority over the tongue and allegiance of God's people? That's the big question. Who gets the authority? Will the God's people submit to the authority of the beast, or will they submit to the authority of the conquering Lamb? Will they follow the way of the slain Lamb, or will they follow the way of power and might that the world has laid out before us? That's the question we have before us here with the 144,000. Now, can y'all give me a little bit of an umbrella of grace here? Because what I'm about to say, you don't have to agree with me on this, okay? I'm giving you permission to not agree with me. But it says that the 144,000, when asked, who are these? It is said that these are the ones who have come through the ordeal. Another way of translating that is, these are the ones who have come through the tribulation. Now, first off, there is a problem with this translation. Because the tense here should not be those who have come through as if it was something in the past, but it should be present, those who are coming through. Now, the reason I'm saying this may be different is because, especially in the South, the primary vision of the end of the world is through what we call dispensationalism. Are y'all familiar with this term, dispensationalism? You're probably familiar with the practical implications of it. If you have read Left Behind or watched the movie Left Behind, this is dispensationalism, okay? It's the understanding that there is a rapture and the church is taken up out of the world in the rapture, and then you have the tribulation, and then there's 3.5 years, good years, 3.5 years of bad, and then Jesus returns and there's the millennial reign. But the primary emphasis is that the church is taken up out of the world before all of this happens. So if you've read Left Behind, familiar with those passages, that's dispensationalism. And dispensationalism is tied to the idea that there is a coming tribulation, right? Like things are going to continue to get worse and worse and worse in the world, until finally the Antichrist is here, and then it ushers in the tribulation. Everything will be good for a season, and then all of a sudden everything will turn bad. And then that's where, when I was a teenager, I don't know why adults let us do this, but when I was a teenager in church, we had movies like, have y'all heard of A Thief in the Night? Some of y'all have heard of this movie. It was a movie that was, I mean, when I was a teenager, even younger than a teenager, we would watch that, and the movie was, I wouldn't let my daughter watch it now, because the end of the movie is about those who were left behind from the rapture, those who were left behind that followed Christ. They could not run until finally they decided they would not take the mark of the beast. And then if you don't take the mark of the beast, everyone was led to the gallows and they just chopped everyone's head off. As a kid, that obviously affected me, right? You're praying every 5 minutes, God save me, God save me, God save me, because I don't want my head chopped off if I miss the rapture. It was scary. It was very freaky. That's the dispensational understanding. It's all tied to the tribulation, that there is a coming tribulation. What John is saying here, he is not referring to a tribulation that is in the future. He is talking of people who are in tribulation now. Remember we said before that John is writing to people in the first century who are facing martyrdom? That, folks, is what we call tribulation. And that is a great tribulation. If you are facing death because of your faith, you might want to call that a tribulation. That's a trial. And so John is not referring to a tribulation that will happen later in the future. John is referring to what the people are going through now. And he says, hey, these are the ones that are even now coming through that tribulation. A lot of people in the West, especially in the United States, have latched on to the understanding of dispensationalism and a tribulation coming later because, quite frankly, we haven't experienced persecution. And I've often talked to people and said that it's almost arrogant for us to say that in the face of all of the people around the world who are facing literal death, for us to say that the tribulation isn't here and that we're expecting it to happen just because we haven't experienced it. What about them? Right? They would say, well, that tribulation in the Bible, that sounds good, because what I'm facing right now actually is worse than that. there's a little bit of an arrogance attached to it. And that the whole dispensational understanding came from a guy named Darby who lived in the 1800s. So before the 1800s, that worldview, even the word rapture, did not appear until the mid-1800s. And honestly, it would have died away if it were not for a guy named Scofield. Some of you have heard of the Scofield Reference Bible. Scofield took Darby's notes and put them, Darby was with the Brethren Church, Plymouth Brethren, I believe, and Scofield put those notes in the bottom of his Bible, and if it was not for Scofield circulating that, you probably would not have heard of that theology today, because he's the one that really kept it alive. If you go to seminary, university, it's not taught there at all. It is primarily a popular belief that is perpetuated through like Left Behind and the movies. This is not an academic way of looking at Revelation. Actually, what I've been presenting to you for the past several weeks is my attempt to take the academic world of Revelation and just bring it into the church, because it's oftentimes not talked about here. So all that to say, let's don't think of this as those who are coming out of the tribulation later. These are the people who are coming out of the tribulation of the first century. And notice, they have on white robes. They are given white robes. And this understanding that they are given white robes, there are several different reasons for this. But all of their allegiances, all of the baggage that they have, is pulled away. And now they are identifying themselves completely with the Lamb. They're putting on the robe. But then they do something odd. You remember when, maybe this didn't happen to you, but when I went away to college for the first time and was doing like laundry and all of that by myself, I learned very quickly that if you take something white and put it in the washing machine with something red, you get pink. Did y'all figure this out?
Yeah.
Okay. I didn't know if it was just my washing machine that did that or not, but that's, I learned that kind of quickly. You can't mix all of that. What happens to their white robes? they're making them spotless, but they're doing that by dipping them in blood. Folks, that doesn't work out. Right? It's very hard to make something spotless that's white by dipping it in blood. I wouldn't suggest you trying that. It doesn't usually work. So they're making their robes, they're taking their robes and they're having them washed in the blood of the Lamb. Why? Well, remember, this is the army. This is the great army that's going to conquer with the Messiah, according to the Jewish belief. Whenever you go off to war and you're preparing yourself for war, you go, and by the way, preparation for war in Jewish culture is quite different. If you flip over to Revelation 14, I believe it is, you will see the 144,000 again who are preparing themselves for war. And if you are preparing yourselves for war, you will abstain from having sexual relations with your husband or wife, it's all males fighting, so with your wife, 24 hours in advance of war, because it's a way of purifying yourself to go off to war. If you notice in chapter 14, it says, these are so prepared for war that they are virgins, have never had sexual relations with a woman. Why? Because they are perfectly clean and prepared for war, and they're going off. So these are the ones who are prepared for battle. And when you go into battle, you might get blood on your clothes. Well, for Jews, if you get blood on your clothes when you're returning from battle, you're considered unclean. And so you have to go through a process of ritual cleansing before you can come back into society after you have been at war. But notice the switch here. They are not cleansing themselves after the battle. They are cleansing themselves in the blood of the Lamb, because the blood of the Lamb has already won the battle. It's a reversal. Do you see that? How beautiful is that? They're not preparing themselves and cleaning themselves after war, because they don't have to go to war at all. The war has already been fought by Jesus. They're washing themselves in the blood of the one who has conquered. So there's nothing that they have to do at this point. They are conquering now in the name of the one who has already conquered. It all goes back to the Lamb who is reigning on the throne. He is the one who is triumphant. He is the one who has come through and has won the battle. They are triumphant because of their solidarity with the slaughtered Lamb. And then in verses 15 through 17, we see this beautiful the beautiful hymn, right? For this reason, they are before the throne of God and worship him day and night within his temple. And the one who is seated on the throne will shelter them. They will hunger no more and thirst no more. The sun will not strike them, nor any scorching heat. For the Lamb at the center of their throne will be their shepherd. And he will guide them to the springs of the water of life. And God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. This beautiful image of hope for those who have come through the ordeal, for those who are in the midst of tribulation, for those who are facing death, for those who are expelled from their homes, for those who are seeing the destruction of the temple. Listen to the beauty of these words. God is the one who will lead you. God is the one who will take care of you. I love this imagery. God is the one who will shelter you. Very literally, that means to tabernacle with you. Remember the tabernacle in the Old Testament? The tabernacle is the place where God lived. Like, you would come to the tabernacle and you would meet God there. It was a sign of God's presence with the people who were wandering through the wilderness. Notice what it says here, that those who have come through the great ordeal, God has not left you, but God has chosen to tabernacle with you. God has chosen to live with you. God has chosen to make his home with you. And that, just to jump to the end of Revelation, that's where we're heading. That's the end, is that God says, I will be your God and you will be my people. I'm going to be with you. But here with these that have come through the ordeal, God says, I choose to live with you. I choose to lead you. I choose to make my home and my dwelling place with you. In the midst of the trials and the tribulation, God has not left them at all. God has been right there with them. Why? Because this God does not conquer through the sword. This God does not conquer through the world's pictures of power. This God conquers through the suffering and the slain Lamb. So when you go through trials, when we go through trials and tribulations, God is right there with us, because this is the God who suffers. This is the God who suffers with us, enters into our suffering, shares that. And that's how God conquers. It's through the suffering. So what does all of this mean? What are the implications of all of this? First off, this is the second time that we've seen this shifting image, right? The first one, we were expecting to see a lion, but we shifted and we saw a lamb. In this case, we're expecting to see the 144,000, the military ready to conquer in the name of the Messiah. But instead, what do we see? People from every nation, tribe, tongue, ready to conquer, not through the sword, but through their worship, through the worship of the Lamb. And notice also in the shifting of that language, we're shifting from this Jewish army to every nation, every tribe, every tongue. Everyone gets included on this. It's not just the Jews. Everyone gets included. And this actually has been since the very beginning. When the Jews were given the covenant, the whole reason they were given the covenant was so that they would then be the means through which and by which God would bless the rest of the world. I'm going to bless you so that through you, all nations will be blessed. This is the fulfillment of that. This is the fulfillment of that blessing. All nations, which you all should be jumping up and down right now, because I don't think any of you are culturally Jewish. You get to be a part of this, because that army has been transformed. And now everyone gets to come in. So we have this transformation of the 144 to the innumerable multitude. So what I would urge us today is to take just a moment. And when John hears the 144,000, he expects to see something that he's been taught all his life. He's expecting that army. He knows what that army looks like. It makes sense to him. But when he turns, what he sees is something that he has never seen before, and it doesn't make sense. And so he has to ask, who are these? Right? Actually, the question is asked of him, but then he turns it back on the person asking, right? Who are these people? There are things that God has done in our lives. There are concepts, beliefs that we have of God that have been with us all of our life. And everywhere we turn, we expect God to work in this way or in that way or in that way. But I'm kind of hoping that through all of this, we start to experience the world more like John, where we maybe expected God to do this, but when we turn, we're opened up to the possibilities of God doing something even bigger. We're expecting the 144,000, but when we turn, we actually allow God to do even more and turn that 144,000 into an innumerable multitude. So I know for myself, I grew up in the church. I was not born in the church, but very close, right? I know who God's supposed to be. I know how God is supposed to work in the world. I need those moments where I'm expecting God to do one thing, but turn around and see something completely different. Now, here's the thing. God does that all the time, but we miss it. So my prayer is that I'll actually see it, and I'll actually be open to seeing it. Because sometimes I can shut it off and say, you know what, I see all of this happening over here, but that's not how God works. And so I dogmatically force myself in this direction because I think this is how God's going to work. And all the time, I may be missing completely what God is doing over here. So I pray that we as a church will live our lives in such a way that we are open to seeing the bigger thing of what God is doing. And maybe at times deviating and saying, okay, so now God is doing this and pushing in that direction. So that's the first thing that I want to take from this. The second thing I want to take from this is that, remember, through all of this imagery, through this imagery of armies and innumerable multitudes and all of that, through all of that, the point is at the center. The point is the Lamb. That's the point around which everything else revolves. So when we get stuck on questions about who's the army, what's that going to look like? Is there rapture, not rapture, all that? it's okay to ask those questions, but at some point, we got to push that aside and remember who's at the center of all of this. It's the slain lamb. It's the slain lamb who is worthy of our praise. Another thing that I would take from this is don't forget that the call of discipleship is a call that was given to you, but it's also a call that has been given to everyone. Notice the innumerable multitude. We don't know who all is going to be there. It's a call that has been given to everyone. So when you walk out these doors, every person you encounter today, think of them. They're either a disciple or soon to be disciple. Think of them like that. Either a disciple or yet to be disciple. The call has been given to us all. And this call, notice, this 144,000 are those who are coming out of tribulation. This call is not to a call of a perfect life. This is a call that, yeah, there's going to be times when you go through persecution, you go through trials, you go through tribulation. There are people who will be put to death for their faith in Jesus. But the beautiful thing about Christianity is that we know that through all of that, and the point of this passage is that through all of that, God is still with us. God has not left us in the midst of that trial, that tribulation. Persecution will come. If you look at Revelation and you somehow think through Revelation that you will escape persecution, you're reading Revelation wrong. There will be persecution. But through that, the Lamb is with us. And the Lamb has already won the battle. And at the end of the day, the Lamb is the one who conquers. So it all centers around the Lamb. I love the quote from, I believe it was Bonhoeffer, "Christ bids us come and die." In the West, we forget that. That's the call of Christ to discipleship. Christ bids us come and die. That's a tough word, isn't it? It's a very tough word. We want to say Christ bids us to come to the happy life. But that's not necessarily the case. Christ bids us to come and die. So the question is asked in Revelation, who is able to stand? And then we see the 144,000. So who is it that's able to stand in the midst of persecution? It's those who remain focused on the Lamb, and it's those who allow their mouths to be opened up and to sing the praises of the one who has conquered. They are the ones who will stand, even in the midst of tribulation and in persecution. So my brothers and sisters, let us keep our eyes focused, laser focused, on the Lamb who is at the center. Let us never drift to the side, but let us proclaim the worship of the one who has conquered. And when those around us rise up and threaten us, remember, their power, their authority is just a sham. The one who really has the power and authority is the one who appears to have died, right in the middle, the conquering Lamb. Let us stay focused and let us worship Him and Him alone. Let's pray.